Howdy, folks, and welcome back here to Expanded Perspectives with me, Cam Hill, and joining me as always is mi amigo sitting over here, Mr. Kyle Filio Filson.
How's it going, everybody? I hope everybody's having a good week. I know it's the start of the week, but I hope let's make it a good one, okay?
Right, for real. I'm fixing to change up the way I do the intro. I'm sure people already know who I am, and they don't care. I don't need to tell them my name. They don't care who I am. They just want to be entertained.
That's true. That's true.
They definitely don't care who you are.
Absolutely not.
It's 100% true. We may change the intro upcoming, but for right now, howdy, folks. Thank you for joining us. Like Kyle said, let's kick this little dumpling off. We're going to try to have some fun this week. We've had a great weekend. Everything's been good. Weather's looking nice. Hope all of our brothers and sisters up north aren't freezing out. I've been noticing they've been dumping a lot of snow up in that area, so everybody stay warm. Get your snow shovels out, and heck, pay some local high school kid to get out there and do some shoveling or whatnot, man. I don't have to worry about the snow like that. I've got my dose, and I get up there, I'm done with it.
Right. Well, so let's get us some news, okay?
What do you got for me? You and I was talking about something strange, and we looked at the photos, and we kind of kicked it around. But yeah, go ahead and get into this, because it really is an interesting story.
Yeah, I'm going to start at the news this week with a little crypto news. Now, this comes to us from the Discovery News, and it was posted by Jennifer Newton. And it's about a farmer who says he's found the remains of two mysterious, get this, chupacabra creatures after stumbling across what are some bizarre-looking dead animals on his farm in Chile. Now, Javier Prohens raises goats in Mont Patria in the east central Chilean province of Lamari. He says one of his farm hands was in an abandoned winery. Now, what he was doing in the winery was not explained, nor whether he was working on or off the clock.
That's the best part of the story.
Right? Like, what is the guy doing off the clock
the guy
in the winery?
In the winery, man, he's just tipping a few back.
Yeah.
He's had a hard week of raising goats in Chile. Can't be easy. Can't be fun. Well, it might be fun. But now he's going to get him a little bit of wine, and then you're going to stumble across something like this. This may knock your buzz off.
Yeah. Well, he says that's when this farmhand found the remains of two creatures that he could not easily identify. Now, Prohens went to the winery and gave this eyewitness account. He said, when we got there, we saw them lying among some hay bales in one of the cellars. At first, we thought they might be bats, but when we looked closer, we realized they had to be something else, as the heads were too big for bats. And then someone said, they look like chupacabras. Now, fortunately, someone took pictures so the remains can be inspected by those who don't have goats to protect. The skulls appear to be elongated and not really bat-like in appearance or size. That would make them closer to the traditional reptilian form of the chupacabra rather than those reported in the U.S. that resemble wild dogs. Now, if you're a fan of the chupacabra, you know that there are two distinct types of chupacabras
yes.
that are reported being seen. Now, the reptilian form, that chupacabra is the one that's most commonly seen in the El Yunque forest in Puerto Rico, because I've been there.
Well, and that started like in 95 when they first started reporting seeing some of that.
That's right. And this thing has spikes down its
wings.
Back, wings sometimes,
yeah.
Glowing eyes, reptilian looking. People have theorized that it might be extraterrestrial, that it's landed its UFO and it's scouting around
pissed.
And stuff. And then it's, you know, sucks the blood of a goat or a
yeah.
chicken or something, or a small child, a cat or a dog, and then gets back in its spaceship and flies off. Others think that the reptilian lives in that forest, which is a giant rainforest, basically. And I've been there. Man, there are snails, and I'm not kidding you. The shells are the size of dinner plates. That's how big these snails are.
Like a football?
Yes, gigantic.
Like an underinflated football?
Yes, much like the Patriots are trying to pull, right? Is that what you're alluding to? Anyways, in the United States, though, we have a different type of chupacabra altogether.
Yeah.
And in our home state of Texas, there's a lot of these things that are seen. Now, to me, the ones that are spotted in Texas, they look like dogs with the mange. I mean, coyotes with the mange, or even what they refer to down here as blue dogs.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, you remember in 2009, CNN actually did a story about them in Blanco, where there was a guy actually took one to a taxidermist and was going to get it mounted. But the taxidermist was allegedly working with took it and was going to work with a university. Now, they never came out and said which one to have it tested. And he believed, what he said he believed is all it was a mutated or a genetically mutated coyote was what he said he believed it was.
Yes.
I've never heard any more out of it. You know what I mean?
We've probably never heard anything more out of it because nothing was there. It was a dog.
But you see these pictures of them, they look a little bit strange. I will give them that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
These pictures that we're talking about here don't look like the same thing we're talking about. They don't look like the remains of a dog.
Yeah, take a look, folks. I'm going to put the photographs and the links in the show notes on the website. Just go to expandedperspectives.com. Find this episode, and you'll see the show notes there. You can click there. You can see the pictures. Cam, what do you think that looks like? I mean, I agree. It does look bizarre.
I'll tell you what I think it looks like, okay. Personally. My opinion of what it looks like, just an opinion. It looks like two dead cats.
Man, that's exactly what I was thinking.
It looks... Right? It does. It just looks like two cats that have died together.
If anybody has been grown up or raised near a farm, I mean, barn cats, they die all the time.
Well, and the way they are
in the
hay...
they breed like crazy.
Yeah. The way they are in the hay... Okay, I'll give you that. There's no hair on them. I don't know if they were ants that had come through. Maybe the ants removed the hair. You know, I don't
Absolutely.
Know.
Absolutely.
It's... There's I don't know enough about the forensics of you know, dying cats. I have no clue. But I do know looking at those pictures. Are they strange? They're very strange.
They are strange.
They're a very, very strange thing. But to say that, of course, you know, they don't really come right out and say, we guarantee you this. Maybe they are, maybe they're not. Nobody really 100% says without a doubt, that's a chupacabra, study it, the whole thing. It does look strange, I'll give it that. But it also looks to me like roadkill. Like, you're driving down the road and you see one. I know going to work, people, you'll see something dead on the side of the road. And if you pass it enough days, you start looking over there like, man, that just looks like leather with feet. Looks like right? Looks like a Wells Lamont work glove with feet. You know, and you're like, what is that? But, and that's kind of what this looks like. So,
well, and another thing is there's no missing goats. They haven't been finding dead goats around. I mean, there's nothing to allude that this is a chupacabra. The guy was probably had one too many wines. He's been hanging out in the cellar for too long, the farmhand. And stumbled across it and was like, what is that? It's got to be a chupacabra.
Well, it makes a great story. And is it intriguing? It's very intriguing. Maybe I'm wrong. I hope I'm wrong.
Right.
I hope they find it and they study it. And that's what they figure out, that it is some kind of other species. That'll be awesome.
Right. Now, no goat remains, as we mentioned, were found. And they don't appear to be any recent reports of unusual flock disappearances in the Mont Patria area. But that hasn't stopped local farmers and parents from worrying. And according to a resident, LeBron, he goes on, Aquin Ruben LeBron, he goes, our livelihoods are built on goat farming. There are a lot of goats here. Although it's said they only attack animals, who knows that it won't attack our children too. Now, chupacabras, are they bats, are they cats, something else? Until they're identified, Javier Prohens and his neighbors will be guarding their kids and their kids.
Right, for sure. And, you know, until you really know what it is, I mean, it's worth looking into. It just so happens that I was on the same website around that same time. This has been in the news. People have sent us links to it and emails, and it's been blowing up our spot because it is extremely interesting if you're into anything historic, if you're into cryptozoology, if you're into anything along those lines. We'll play a little clip for you. Why don't you listen to this fella tell his story right quick, and we'll come right back from that.
David Gillett is skipper of the Western Alliance vessel at Lake's Entrance. Mr. Gillett, good afternoon.
Yeah, good afternoon.
So did you catch this shark, this frill shark?
Yeah, I did, Tom, yep.
Have you ever seen one before?
No, I've been at sea for 30 years and I haven't never seen a shark look like that.
Well, tell us what it looks like. I mean, I've just described it from a picture I've got in front of me as like a large eel. You've seen it. What did it look like?
Yeah, you're right. It was like a large eel. That's right. Probably about a meter and a half long. No, probably 1.5 meters long. But and the body was quite different to any other shark I'd ever seen. But the head on it was quite a something like out of a horror movie. It was quite horrific looking. With a really big opening mouth and. It was quite scary, actually. It came up alive, like not alive enough that you could return it to the water. It wouldn't survive, of course. It came out of probably 1,100 metres. Okay. So, yeah, really deep.
Does it have teeth in its mouth, or does it have something else?
Oh, yeah, no. Look, it had rows of teeth, Tom. And but the crazy part about it is we caught a lot of sharks in my life, but it seemed quite... It was really looking at you and quite aggressively going for you. So the amazing thing was that when one of the deckhands went to pick it up by its tail, its ability to turn back on itself quite sharply was something I hadn't seen before either. So
you were still able to, you know, turn around and try and bite one of your deckhands, but you say you couldn't throw it back in?
Oh, look, no, Tom. I mean, it had enough go in it to be trying to still protect itself. But at the end of the day, it was on its last legs, and we'd never seen anything like that before. So I kind of felt it was a bit more important to keep it. It wasn't going to survive, and I wanted to get an ID on it.
That's right, folks. There is a rare frilled shark whose species, kind of like the coelacanth, actually dates back 80 million years was caught in a fishing trawler's net off of the Australia's coast.
Man, is that thing not creepy looking?
It looks like it. Like the guy says, it looks like a giant eel with teeth, except it's got blue eyes, man. It is disturbing.
Yeah, they're pretty. It's very creepy looking. Once again, I'm going to put them in the show notes. You can take looks at the thing. I didn't realize it was so big. I mean, it looks like they said it's like almost 6 foot long, yes. Which they say is like the peak of the size that they get to. That's pretty much the biggest that's that they get.
Exactly.
And what it's normally used to being at very deep water fish. Mm-hmm. And somehow this one stumbled up much higher and they accidentally caught the thing.
Well, Simon Boag, which is the chief executive officer of the Southeast Trawl Fishing Association, actually talked to Australia's ABC Rural, and they have a quote. He says, it's a freaky thing. I don't think you would want to show it to little children, he said, before they went to bed. And I couldn't agree more. Now, the association that he's with, you know, he says that the frilled shark's often referred to as a living fossil.
Yeah.
And it describes what he describes. It says it has an eel-like body. It's got three fins on its back. And it gets its names from the six pairs of gill slits that give it a fringed appearance. Now, I don't know enough about deep water critters, but maybe that, of course, has to do with something for him being at that depth. He needs all those rows of gills. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Now, but it's right. 6 feet is kind of like the maximum, I guess you could say, that it reaches. Here's the creepy thing. It's got 300 teeth in 25 rows.
Yeah, right.
They
say
they believe it captures its prey by bending its body like a snake. So it's like a big 6 foot tall needle mouthed snake working its way through the water. Yet again, another reason I'm not getting in the ocean. That's it. That's the perfect reason right there. Just show them a picture of it. But like you said, they're usually deep water things. Now, this shark was caught. Get a load of this. 2,296 feet deep. Is where they caught this thing.
Yeah, and I believe they said that thing, even that is a high elevation for them. That normally they're deeper than that is where they live.
Now how wild. And that's ridiculously deep.
Yeah.
Now, Boag goes on to say, said this guy was just unlucky, but that it was because the shark was caught in shallower depths than it's usually found.
Yeah, right.
Right? Now, of course, David, the guy you heard talking, that there was the captain of the Western Alliance vessel, you know, he told that in that story, but he talks about that he's been there for my favorite thing about it. He's been at sea, he said, for 30 years, and he's never seen a shark that looks like that.
Yeah, well, apparently they don't catch them very often.
Nope.
Anybody?
No. Nope.
And I was looking at a world range and habitat map on the internet.
Yeah.
And Cam, they're all along the eastern coast of the United States. So
nope. And there's probably not been any, like, hopefully not any attacks of these creatures. You know,
I don't think there's been any
people.
No,
but,
I don't think
I don't want to find out if they're... Dude, I'm telling you, man. Everybody laughs at me and they post stuff and all this stuff. But it is. I do not like anything like that. It's a creepy, creepy deal.
Especially when you see what it looks like.
Yes. 100%. 100%. So, I don't know. I don't enjoy it. But I did find something else. Before we go any further, I got something else that I think everybody's going to enjoy.
Okay.
Because I was looking at that, I'm like, I got to do something else. And I got into history, and there's a lot of folks have been, I had some friends of mine I train at the gym with actually send me some of these links. It comes, Mark Miller actually wrote this. It comes from Ancient Origins again, folks. I'm sure y'all have seen it. It's Ancient Artifacts and Human Remains Surface as a Glacier Melts. Now, you remember the Iceman? Remember they found the guy way up in the top in France?
Yeah.
And all that? Well, this is kind of what's going on again is... In 2014, this past summer, in a Norwegian county there's a team of archaeologists found around 400 stone artifacts that as the glaciers started to melt up there, they went to uncovering this stuff. Now, this comes from the Science Nordic in a 2015 article of this month, and it says that mittens, shoes, weapons, and walking sticks lost in the high mountains of Norway thousands of years ago are now emerging from the melting ice.
Right.
Now, look. We've all been, well, I say we've all, Kyle and I, we've been on deer leases and we've been out in South Texas and all around it, and we found arrowheads, and I've never found a complete one. I found broken ones and broken spear tips and lots of shards and stuff of flint. And it's amazing when you find these old things. I mean, I get a charge every time because I pick them up and I'm like, whoa, what would, you know, can you imagine what this saw? I can't imagine finding those things in the ice. Like if you're just a hiker walking away around up in there and you find across it, that would be insane. Now, Lars Pilo, the archaeologist who leads the Norwegian team, said Earth should be approaching a new ice age, but instead people are recovering artifacts from melting glaciers like never before. Now, this phenomenon is not just limited to Norway. Now, all over the world, as the glaciers are melting and receding, archaeologists and hikers, of course, because they're the ones out doing it more, are finding artifacts and remains of humans and animals from hundreds of thousands of years ago. Now, the topic is so prevalent that the Equinox Publishing has established, you ready for this?
Yeah.
An online journal of glacial archaeology. And that will report on the archaeological discoveries from glacial, permafrost, polar, and high-altitude frozen contexts from around the world.
That's pretty crazy, right?
It says the main themes will include archaeological analysis of recovered frozen artifacts, interpretations of frozen finds in relation to past and present climates, problems and solutions related to managing, monitoring, and rescuing frozen deposits, as well as social, political, and ethical issues related to these discoveries from Europe, North and South America, Asian, and Antarctica.
Man, that's pretty neat.
It's because they found some really interesting stuff. Like I said, the Iceman. It's what's funny. I got a kick out of it was the old tattoos that they found on the guy. You know, like it looked like he had tattooed or somebody had tattooed like a shaman pressure points and certain things. And a lot of those lined up to pressure points and stuff. It was neat. Now, in 2013, in archaeology.com, they did a 7-page article about this phenomenon. And they say the pressure to find, document, and conserve the exposed artifacts is tremendous, and that the next 50 years will be decisive. Now, that's Albert Hafner. Now, he's an archaeologist from the University of Bern who actually excavated melting sites there in the Alps when he was there. Says if you don't do it now, they will be forever lost. And that makes sense.
Yeah, because once they're exposed to open air, they really start rotting and falling apart, right?
They degrade in a hurry. Now, in 2005, there's an online magazine called GeoTimes, and they actually reported on the phenomenon, and they say an ancient frozen body has to be one of the most valuable things on Earth. Now, that's Johann Reihard, the archaeologist working there at the National Geographic, and he's right. Now, he found the Inca Ice Maiden in the Andes in 95.
Right.
Remember that whole deal,
yes,
too.
I do.
And GeoTimes also reported another find from August of 99 when three sheep herders in the Tashinshini Alsek Park in the northern B.C. came across a well-preserved human body, minus, of course, the head that was poking out of the ice.
Right.
It was around 500 to 600 years old. Now, that's where the body was with tools and a hat and like a robe, and it had like a, this is the cool part, a pouch of like a smoked or dried salmon with it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it had...
That's what I think is so cool. I've seen them with snuff containers and things before, different tools, like you said, the tattoos, jewelry,
yeah.
Even like, you know, sandals or flip-flops, as they call them here.
Yeah.
You know, it is pretty neat.
And the quiver with the arrows and the bow.
And I guess as these glaciers are melting, there's just more and more things being exposed. I wonder how many more bodies we're going to find. And it reminds me of, do you remember Otzi?
That's the one I'm talking about. That's the tattoo guy.
Right. Yeah. He was found in 1991 on the border between like Austria and Italy.
That's him.
Right. Now, Otzi, what I think is neat about Otzi is, you know, he's supposedly like 5,300 years old. They actually took some of the samples from Otzi, okay? Get this. And they did DNA samples, and they've actually traced it. He has living relatives today in that region still.
Are you serious?
I'm dead serious.
Oh, that's cool.
They had they took like 19 genetic relatives they've found so far in that area, which is called Tyrol, which is in the Austrian-Italy border. But it's pretty cool that there's living descendants now that can be still tied back to that guy from 5,300 years ago.
That's awesome.
It's still passed on the genes. I mean, that is incredible.
That's cool. Well, they're okay. To wrap it up, they're in southern Norway, Paolo, the one that we talked about in his group. They conduct field work over what they consider to be an ancient route over the mountains where the glacier is now melting. He says thousands of years ago, people crossed the mountains there, of course, to travel from place to place, and I'm sure to trade and all that, and then they would go back and forth to like high summer farms. And from what they're finding, it shows that they've left many of artifacts just laying around up there, and a lot of them associated, of course, with hunting. But of course, he goes on to say that they found shoes and mittens, but they've also found skeletons of horses that died while they were trying to cross the mountains.
That's pretty cool.
And he says it's awesome, but he says among the things his crew found in 2014 were hiking staffs, walking sticks, a horse skull from the Viking Age, and they also found, this is probably my favorite, an arrow shaft from the Stone Age.
Right.
But there's tons and tons of stuff, and like you're talking about now, like you brought up, the organic matter deteriorates extremely fast when it's exposed to air. They say the wood artifacts will only last maybe a few years once it's out of the ice melt. So what they say to recover leather before it dries out and just completely, they have a week. So
yeah,
when
see?
It melts, you've got a week to get on it. Now, of course, we know as far as flesh, you probably got 3 days.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. How many of these bodies have been exposed and then predators just eat them and scatter the bones and no one ever knows about it?
Yeah.
I mean, it could happen all the time, right?
Yeah. I love the idea of all the stuff they could find. And I like the idea that they're bringing attention to it now, that now people are going to start looking. You know, maybe they can start using, what were you talking about, like they did with the Finding Bigfoot. They're going to put little cameras on the drones and fly them up over the glaciers. Maybe they can start looking and finding stuff there.
I got a drone story for you coming up.
Oh, what do we got?
I'll get to that in a minute. Did you see this, folks? Now, you're going to be upset. Talk about some real boneheads. Did you see that King Tut's burial mask has been irreversibly damaged? This comes from IO9.
What do you talk? His goatee, that blue goatee thing?
Yes.
Are you serious?
I'm dead serious.
Oh, no.
The most famous archaeological relic in the world has been damaged during a botched cleanup attempt. After being knocked off, the blue and gold braided beard on King Tut's burial mask was hastily glued back on with an inappropriate adhesive, damaging the item even further.
Officials at the Egyptian Museum in Cairo confirmed the blue and gold braided beard on Pharaoh Tutankhamun's 3,000-year-old burial mask was knocked off, possibly in a botched cleaning job. But whatever carelessness resulted in the beard's detachment pales in comparison to the utter ineptitude displayed in the repair job, where a tourist photo of workers using a permanent epoxy is making headlines around the world. Generously described by the museum as an inappropriate adhesive, the sloppy glue job not only resulted in a very visible glue layer on the base of the chin, but also the worker apparently dribbled epoxy on the mask's face and then scratched up the mask trying to remove the glue splatters with a spatula. It's just unbelievable. I mean, what kind of qualifications do you need to become a restorer at the Egyptian Museum? Some history with Spanish frescoes? Bus 60. Now you know, pass it on.
It's not funny that it's damaged. It's funny for the guy that did it. You think he was fired before that thing hit the floor?
Oh, my God. Brace yourself, okay? This story is messed up. I mean, the Associated Press is the one that reported this, and it appears that the beard was quickly glued back on by curators at the Egyptian Museum in Cairo with epoxy.
No joke, it was quickly glued back on. You know why? Because only one man knew about it at the time. He was like, uh-oh, I snapped
it off. Apparently there was three guys that did it.
Oh, you can't have that. You got to kill the other two.
Right? And the thing is they glued it on in front of people that are tourists. They did it right in front of everybody.
They broke it off with people in the room.
Yeah.
Oh.
That's what they couldn't. It wasn't like it was back door, you know, behind a closed door or anything.
Oh, my
goodness. It happened right in front of everybody. Now, and if you don't know what epoxy is like an irreversible material. I mean, once it's like two components,
it's there.
Mix it, and once it sets up. So, I mean, it's really messed
folks,
up.
If you're listening to this on Monday and you're at work and you think you're having a bad Monday, things could always be worse. You could be those guys.
Yeah, I mean, everybody's screwed up. Everybody's accidentally broken something
or
spilled
never
something.
Up before?
Yeah, but this is a major screw up.
I've never broke the goatee off King Tut's death mask.
Right.
I'm going to start thinking of that at work. When things are going bad, it always could be worse. I could be the guy that epoxied the goatee on slightly off center on King Tut's death mask.
Well, and you're going to find this part of the story amazing. Much like children, it isn't really clear exactly who was at fault because three of the museum's curators are all offering conflicting accounts as to what happened.
Imagine that. Right? Imagine that.
Now, get this. It says, I quote, "The masks should have been taken to the conservation lab, but they were in a rush to get it on display quickly again and use this quick-drying, irreversible material."
J.B. Weld.
The conservator said that the mask now shows a huge gap between the face and the beard, whereas before it was directly attached. Now you can see a layer of a transparent yellow fluid between. I mean, look, obviously,
I would tell everybody, it's amber. You know, in another 1,000 years, if we're still around, they're going to be like, that was amber that they used to connect that to. They're going to make up some crazy thing.
Look, if you accidentally knock the beard off, they're exactly right. You should take it in the back and fix the thing properly.
Take your time.
No, these guys, these jackwagons, looked around, I guess thought they were going to lose their job, got the epoxy and tried to stick it back on there.
Right? I picture the three stooges. Whoop, 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 whoop. Ah, you knucklehead, come here. Yeah. And they got to try to glue it back on. Right. Water's running out of stuff.
Well, Cam, that's not the end. The story gets worse. It appears
I just read it. They took those three men out back and shot them.
No.
They were all three found in a shallow grave.
No, that would be a good
outside
thing.
Outside of Cairo.
Get this. It appears it was when the curators were moving hastily and quickly doing it, they inadvertently gotten some of the epoxy on the face of the mask too. And then they used a spatula in an effort to get it off, which damaged it even more.
And those men are curators over there. And we wonder why we can't get the truth out of Egyptian antiquities.
Oh,
because these guys have no idea what they really are. The three stooges working in the thing over there. Didn't they have one about mummies? Wasn't it an old school Three Stooges where they were talking about, they had like the mummies and all that in Egypt? I'm pretty sure it was. That was that whole thing.
Well, another museum curator that wasn't part of this, you know, debacle says that, yep, it's true. The epoxy had dried on the face of the boy king's mask and that a colleague used a spatula to remove it, leaving scratches. It says, I inspect the artifact regularly and it's clear that there are scratches now that was used by that was created by some tool in an attempt to scrape off the epoxied dabble on King Tut's mask.
It was created by a tool, all right.
Right? I mean, are you kidding me?
Yes.
So not only did they accidentally knock the beard off, I mean, then they did a botched up job gluing it on. Apparently, it's not straight. It's not crooked. There's a gap on it. Then they got epoxy on his face, and then they used a tool, a spatula, to scrape it off, which damaged it more. I mean, talk about monumental screw-ups.
And we're not talking about one of those Teflon spatulas. We're talking about like a metal barbecue grill just dragging across and scratching it up.
Like a mason laying brick is what I'm thinking of. One of those big metal spatulas. I mean, you talk about a monumental
screw-up.
You could not screw up any worse than that. I really don't think so. It's like you said, the Three Stooges. That's what you think of when you think of who was doing this. Insane.
Oh, my goodness. Well, you're going to have to cheer me up. You're going to have to cheer me up. We were talking about this a little bit off, but you're going to have to cheer me up with this.
Yeah, okay, get this. Now, this comes from Gizmodo, and it was posted by Gerald Lynch. It talks about a drone that crashed while trying to deliver 6 pounds of meth across the U.S. and Mexico border.
Na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-it comes flying over full of meth.
Exactly. Now, the future of drug smuggling lies not within the stomachs of lined people or mules, you know, to smuggle drugs across. These guys are using state-of-the-art drones.
These days, criminals will try just about anything to get away with their crime. And this latest stunt is flying proof. Tijuana police found a drone packed with more than 6 pounds of meth after it came crashing down near the Mexico-California border.
I was shocked. It was definitely a shock. It was only a matter of time before someone tried something like this.
Apparently, a witness called the cops after watching it fall from the sky and land in the parking lot of a supermarket. Police don't know who was trying to airlift the drugs, but say it may have crashed because it was overloaded.
There's a lot of modifications that can be made. You can put larger power transmitters on them. There's some people that try and modify the radios to have a longer range.
Yes, this is one plan that just didn't take off.
Now, the drone that they used is called a Spreading Wing 900. And this drone is used what they use, they attach cameras to film documentaries and movies and things, even sporting events. And they have about a 20-minute battery lifetime. And I guess these guys got a camera attached to this drone as well as the drugs. And, man, they're flying them across the border. How ingenious is that?
And for what man, it is pretty awesome. It really... Look, I know it's drug dealing, but it is pretty awesome to think that this is what it's moved to. This is the new Scarface. This is the new thing.
Well, it's way better than Scarface. Right? I mean, these guys are cutting edge using drones.
What kills me, though, is the fact that they say it takes like 18 to 20 minutes is all the battery life that they have.
Yeah.
But they're saying it can go a pretty good ways. I'm trying to think. I wonder how far you could fly one. I wonder how fast it really...
Like, what's the range?
Yeah, what the range would be.
I don't think it has to be very much. I mean, I'm picturing in my mind that... They're only flying the thing like 1,000 yards. You're on this side of the border. You fly it over that fence, and you drop it down in somebody's bed of their pickup, and then they take off, and the drone comes back.
Well, and you know, too, like, especially in the mountains, it's usually all by line of sight the way those things fly. So if you're up on top of a ridge in the middle of the night and you take it off, you could probably fly it a long ways down, like you said, and just got to clear the border. You drop it down.
Well, they got cameras on it.
Yeah.
So the guy flying it, it's like playing a video game. It says that the U.S. Border Patrol on Tuesday received a tip that a drone had crashed in a Mexican shopping center park in Tijuana. And on it was 2.7 kilograms of methamphetamine, which is worth on the street roughly about $1,500. Now, what's puzzled authorities is how long have they been doing this? And get this, Cam, it says border authorities around that area have found up to 150 drones so far that have been doing this.
Really?
So these guys are operating 150 drones at one time, and they're just brr, brr, like you're saying. I mean, and it says they've been using these drones since 2012.
Okay, I just pulled this up. I'm looking right now at the brand new drones. The brand new, this style, whatever this thing is. This
the Spreading Wing 900.
Yeah, it's called the Spreading Wing S900. I'm looking at it right now.
The DJI Spreading Wings S900 was born out of the desire to distill our most powerful technology into a lightweight, easy-to-carry aerial system. It's your on-the-go flying platform, perfect for capturing amazing aerial footage while providing unmatched flexibility. Our main design challenge was almost a paradox. We wanted to reduce size and weight while increasing power and usability. To overcome this challenge, we equipped the S900 with six of our most advanced motors, large 15-inch propellers, and our faster response speed controllers. All of this gives you the ability to fly with almost 5 kilograms of equipment loaded onto the compact 3.3 kilogram frame. We were able to make the S900 light by crafting the arms out of carbon fiber. These new arms are not only lighter, but are stronger, more stable, and more durable, inspiring confidence in a product that is meant to be taken places and used to create. The arms and propellers fold down, reducing its size for transport. Simply extend the arms, lock them into place, and you can be ready to fly in as little as 5 minutes.
Its maximum payload is 8.2 kilograms.
Right.
Okay, that's, so you're talking, we were only running a little over what, two? That's what we're talking about is in this story. That's all it is, isn't it? It's
like, well, it says they found 2.7 kilograms of methamphetamine, but that the thing was loaded with 6 pounds of meth. So I guess it lost. What they think happened is that they put too much weight on the thing, and they couldn't control it, and it crashed, and all they were able to recover was a small amount.
Well, that's what it's talking here, is that if you overload it like this, they're talking 2 meters is hovering height. That's as high as it can get off the ground if it's overloaded like that. And this 18 minutes, they say, is on is maximum flight time on a breezeless day.
Oh, right.
So they're probably just, they're using it for puddle jumpers. That's all it is. It's just enough to clear the water and land on the ground on the other side, and the guys pull it off, and then they bring it back. It's not like they're flying it into some spot. See, that's in my mind's eye, that's what they were doing, was flying it into some secret area and landing it. No, these are just, I guess, because you can't throw it far,
because if it was a gigantic drone or a helicopter, it's spottable by radar. Something this small, they probably can't pick up on radar. Oh, yeah. Nor are they looking for it. I mean, to them, it just looks like a bird.
And do you know why they call it spreading wings?
No, I have no idea.
Because it collapses. Looks like this thing could collapse up and fit under the seat of your truck.
That's pretty cool,
so
right?
So that's why they do it. You can collapse it up, put it in a backpack, hike up in the woods, pull your drone out, load your meth on it, and fly your meth over to your homie. He takes the meth off, puts the money on it, and flies the dumpling back.
That's pretty cool.
It's, you know what? Leave it up to these drug dealers to come up with something ingenious. Just like when they were building those damn submarines. Remember when they were showing
all those? Yeah, I saw that. I saw a National Geographic special on it.
Yeah, it's the same deal. Now they got some crazy drone guys. Before long, they're going to be building their custom-built drones and flying them, and it's going to be a whole new deal. But yeah, that's pretty crazy. Well, folks, we're going to jump out here. We got some historical stories we're going to get into when we come back. And I think you're really going to enjoy it. So stick around. We'll jump into a little bit of, we're going to talk about some Anubis caves. But first, I'm going to talk about a little bit of a Mayan influence in Georgia. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives.
And you're back with Expanded Perspectives. Cam, we're going to be talking about, in this upcoming feature, about some petroglyphs, some different sites. You're doing one in Georgia.
Yeah.
And I'm going to talk about one in Oklahoma, specifically talking about the Kennemer site and the Anubis Caves. You were telling me off air some really interesting stories about the Maya connection in some of these sites.
Well, it's strange. Yeah, it really is strange. I brought it up on the last Elite show that we had. Told a little bit of stories and kind of linked it along in there with that. And, well, I guess it was one of those deals. I was talking, folks. I make mistakes all the time. And this is a prime example of even what Kyle and I talked about the last show with the Dogon and things like that. And I'm going to kind of get into that if you'll kind of see where this is going. The Kennemer site is one of those ones that was talked about on America Unearthed. And I believe they talked about it when the Maya connection with George, and they talked about the blue pigment and things. And I've brought that up, but I'll get into it with you. I'll kind of share with you right now. Now, it's in southeast Georgia. It's, the southeast side of Brasstown, which is near Sauteuil, Georgia. It's in White County. Now, it actually contains two earthworks, okay?
Uh-huh.
Two, and what they say, mounds. Now, Mound A is actually the largest of the two sites, and that's 150 foot above the level of the floodplain of that river area there. And they say it's approximately 1,450 foot above sea level. Now, because both these mounds are located on a really irregularly shaped hill, it's a natural hill,
mm-hmm.
but because they're located on that, they can't really get their exact dimensions. You remember they had to fly a plane over, because in that show, he wasn't allowed to go in there, you know?
And they were using some kind of space age radar, right? Yeah, or sonar or something to map the earth.
Yeah. And that's what they were doing, so he could get a layout of it, you know, on these terraces and all of this stuff. Now, of course, Mound B is on the west of Mound A. Now, they're both mounds are like the northeastern edges are in a straight line, and of course, this summit they say it's a square. It's a 12 meter square, and then the elevation varies on each side, and it's generally not much more than like a meter in height of variance. So it's a slight little climb, you know, as it goes up. But like they say, now the fact that the site is actually on top of and utilizes basically whoever built it on top of a natural hill as part of the whole thing is what's different. They say it's almost like you, for the lack of a better terms, like you built a pyramid already there, you know, an earthen earthworks, and then they went to the very top and built it on the top instead of building mm-hmm. it. It's kind of strange, they were saying. But now I'm going to get into the excavations. Now, when the whole site was mapped out, of course, and excavations were actually performed, they didn't start till the summer of 97 when they really started doing this. Now, this was under the direction of a fellow named Mark Williams, and he was actually part of the University of Georgia and for the archaeological field school there for the Department of Anthropology. So it's not like a guy that didn't know what he was doing when he got there. You know what I mean? It's
yeah,
not like
exactly.
This guy knew what he was going on or what was up. Now, here's the strange thing about all this. There was very little human habitation debris ever found on the mounds.
So they weren't living there.
Well, that's what it leads them to conclude. They think that it was only used for a very short time, and it was only used for ceremonial purposes. All right? Because they say that if you were to, it would be really hard to have a village in that area of the mounds around them where they're at. Which makes sense. I mean, it makes sense. Okay, they've built this thing up on top, and this is, you know, it's a ceremonial deal, and they only go up there for special occasions or special events. Now, they say some lithic debris and pottery, of course, was found at the site. Now, all the ceramic pottery shards that were found there were dated to the late Woodland period, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Which is roughly, they say, 900 CE, current event times 900. They actually call it the Napier phase. Now, the lithic debris that was found at the site, here's something else, was also all locally available. It was all quartz, and they said it was ridge and valley chert, which chert is like flint. So they're making, you know, spear tips and things like that, all from northwestern Georgia area. So it lends you to believe that it was possibly just the natives of that area built all this, or just, you know, maybe it was built before they got here and all that, because they want you to believe, not yet, but it's fixing to get turned into where it was the Maya. Now, there was a small green stone kelt that was actually found there during a pothole test on the very top of Mound A, which was, they were like, huh, I wonder where that came from. And it could have came from trading. We know that there was some trading going on. But anyhow, the controversy in this whole thing starts. Now, mind you, they started excavating in 1997.
Right.
It wasn't until December of 2011 that there was an architect fella named Richard Thornton. Now, he was writing for a thing called The Examiner, a website, theexaminer.com.
Uh-huh.
And he started making claims that the mound was of Mayan origin. Now, I believe Richard was actually on the television series with Scott. Now, Mark, we've talked about before from the University of Georgia, who had actually spent 3 days surface collecting at that site, stated that the Maya connection to legitimate Georgia archaeology is wild and unsubstantiated guess on the part of the Thornton fellow. So he didn't believe it. This archaeologist.
So wait a minute. The Thornton guy is just claiming it's Mayan, but he doesn't really have any proof to back it up. Like, why does he just throw that out there?
Well, he's. It sounds like some of it was extremely unsubstantiated, and that's what we'll get into. Now, in 2010, Johannes Lubster wrote in a peer-reviewed journal over this whole thing. All right, and he actually stated that the excavations at what they call the Track Rock site, which on the opposite side of the mountain from the Kennemer site that we just started discussing,
mm-hmm.
had been halted, he says, when graves were discovered, and that it was probably prehistoric. Now, the excavations performed by Loubser were also used by Thornton as evidence for his theory. Okay.
Okay.
So Thornton heard this, was like, oh, there's ancient graves here. They stopped it. This must be a Mayan civilization, this whole thing. So now, of course, upon learning this, Loubser himself came out and said, I think that Thornton selectively presents the evidence. Says, but he's a better marketer than I and other archaeologists. When you make a claim like that, you have to back it up with hard evidence. And there's a lot of opinion out there, but archaeology is backbreaking work.
Yeah.
All right. So now, okay. We get into that. Well, people instantly, then they went to pointing to what they call this. There's a big boulder there that's called the Forsyth Petroglyph. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's just a rock that features some engravings, basically. Now, they first discovered this rock of Forsyth, of course, Petroglyph, in the early 1800s. Now, it sits in front of the anthropology department at the University of Georgia right now. And for nearly 200 years, the designs on this boulder, there was no way of, they just couldn't interpret it. They had no idea what was going on. Now, they claim over the last few years that the petroglyph has actually started kind of being more and more studied, more and more understood. Now, it was first, of course, back in 2004 that the designs looked astronomical. Now, we talked about archaeoastrology before, so they start looking at this. And, of course, in Nature, and that the they thought that the boulder could represent a star map, that's what it was actually. Now, of course, there was a first attempt at interpreting this boulder, and, of course, later on the research that they found actually kind of supported this theory. But it revealed that they were two of these designs on this boulder were identical to the constellation Draco and Scorpio.
Okay.
Okay. So, and there was an incomplete star symbol that they thought kind of looked like it represented a supernova. Now, the research also revealed that there were several other symbols on it that likely represented a comet, which broke up into several fragments. So now we're getting into these cataclysms. Remember, you and I have discussed that.
Yeah.
So they're saying, oh, well, maybe that was what it was. These guys have carved up something that
a story saw, telling a story. What happened to them.
Exactly. That happened to them. And now, of course, they know for a fact that such an event did really occur in 536 AD. Okay. So mm-hmm. that's instantly they were like, okay, they see this Draco, they see this Scorpio, they know that this was in this area. They're like, all right, well, then it could have been created sometime after 536 AD. All right.
Uh-huh.
And then, of course, like I said, now the latest research supports that previous research that the petroglyph represents a record of this comet breakup. So it's supporting it. They're going back and people are saying, okay, this really might make sense. But now this research has made a little bit of something new kind of pop up. First, there were two Mayan symbols that are found on this Forsyth petroglyph.
Right.
The first symbol, as they say, is identical to what the Aztecs called Cipactl. And the Maya call the cosmic crocodile. And apparently he's represented by the Aztecs as a decapitated head of an alligator. And in Mayan mythology, the cosmic crocodile was decapitated, which led to a massive flood.
Oh, from the blood.
Exactly. Now, according, of course, to the hieroglyphic inscriptions in the temple down there at the Mayan site of Palenque, which is southern Mexico state, which we're getting down to where y'all have been running around. The decapitation and flood occurred around 3300 BC. Now, that's about 200 years before the end of the previous Mayan calendar, okay?
Yes.
Now, of course, the interpretations of this myth show that it records the breakup of a comet, like we talked about, whose fragments slam into the Earth's oceans, all right? And that's what caused, of course, mega tsunamis, destroyed all the civilizations living along the coastlines. And then, of course, we already know that there is actual evidence of climatic change, geological changes from all that. Also, ice core records show that there was comet struck and that it really did occur in and around, let's say, with almost exact precision, 3300 BC. They know that there was something hit there. They were like, okay, well, the Mayans must have known it. So the Mayans, in turn, must have carved it on this Forsyth petroglyph. That's the way it went. Now, the Eastern State Rock Research Association website actually has a quote that says, visitors to the University of Georgia in Athens will find two petroglyph boulders on the campus ground. One is located next to the Museum of Art. The other is within an enclosed garden at the School of Law. These petroglyphs were removed from their original locations in the 1960s. The original location of the stones were near Cumming, Forsyth County, Georgia. The petroglyphs are carved on coarse crystalline granite. Design elements include concentric circles, stick figures, and cupules. Archaeologists believe that the petroglyphs were made by ancestors of the Cree or Cherokee, dating back to the late Woodland period, which is what we've discussed already, around 1000 AD. So the Forsyth petroglyph actually predate the Cree culture, therefore the Cree and the Maya couldn't have used the exact same symbols to record the exact same event. So it's almost like they're lending more information into this. So this is one of those smoking guns to where you're like, well, it could be just, you know, I hate to use the word
coincidence.
Exactly. I hate to use the coincidence or the run of the mill for these that this lines up. Or it could be Mayan. This is one of those ones you're like, ooh, we need to get into some pottery. Now, there's doing some new research in the last few years about on some symbols that have appeared on this some pottery. They're found in Georgia. That's extremely old, and it's actually identical to some Mayan glyphs or symbols that are used to write some of the Mayan language. Now, this pottery is extremely highly decorated. It's very high, you know, it's really fancy pottery. It's called Swift Creek is what it's known as. And they believe it was produced around 2,000 years ago. So, you know, we're talking 2,000 AD. You know, I mean 0 AD. I mean, we're talking like right at the start. They believe that's when it was done. Now, if you go, there's a book out, and I found it's called A World Engraved, Archaeology of the Swift Creek Culture. And you can see a lot of the pictures of it. All right, you can pull it up. Now, there's a lot of researchers have noted the similarity designs with Mexican symbols, and they have been completely dismissed, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So they were just like, it is just total coincidence that this has happened. But now there's some newer research that they think that they can prove that the Mayan glyphs are actually what's on this pottery. So they're saying that this is tying it more into Georgia.
Now, I wonder, do they think that Mayans were residing in that area of Georgia or through just trade that this pottery was traded up from South America to Georgia? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I know exactly.
Just because I have a razor here from Germany doesn't mean that, you know, Germans are living here.
Yeah. Well, that's kind of where it ties into that we were talking, you and I have brought up about the idea of the blue pigment that was found in the Mayan culture in that big pool and all this, you know, and they were talking about the blue pigment that they can also say that they didn't really match the blue. They matched the pigment. I'm sorry, they matched the clay it was used. And they say
I think of the movie Apocalypto.
Yes. Yes.
When they're marching them.
Yep. And they're painted all in that blue and all. It's the same stuff. Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Well, the archaeologists have searched all over down there for this source of this pigment. And, of course, they say the largest source of that kind of clay that matches that pigment is found in southwest Georgia. And it's found in the same location of the Komoki mounds.
Komoki. I think he was a wrestler, wasn't
he? Komoki. Yeah.
I'm thinking of Kabuki.
Kabuki. That's the dude that spit that green stuff. Yeah. The Komoki mounds or so. But anyway, it's... They said this is a real populous site there. Now, of course, now, like I said, these were found there in Mexico, and it's down around Teotihuacan. And they said they can't ever understand why such a populous site was located in such an isolated area. So it could have been the fact that they were trying to mine this clay or use it. You know, who knows? It's one of those. It's open to conjecture. It's open to all this speculation. But they discovered a nearby source of Maya blue pigment. And like I said, they think that's how it solved. The Maya blue, of course, is what we talked about that they painted their bodies up with, you know, on Apocalypto.
Yeah.
But they believe that they used the clay that was found in Georgia because it was actually found in other Mesoamerican cultures. The Aztec found it. And that's when people first started going, well, wait a minute. Could it have been traded? Could this have been something that they carried in a bag, carried in a bowl, carried in something to trade? Now, the Maya, in fact, specifically considered the clay from which the pigment was made, you ready? The most valuable item of the trade.
Really?
Yes.
So they really wanted that blue clay color.
Well, and that I guess that clay held that color better than anything else. Now, there's a sample from a deposit that was first reported years ago that chemically matched that from Chichen Itza. All right.
Oh, so they know it's from Chichen Itza.
Yeah, it matches it exact. So
because I was going to theorize maybe geologically the same type of clay is in Georgia as in the Mayans' homeland in South America, but if they're genetically able to match it, then there's no doubt it comes from that area.
Well, it does come from that area, but it comes from a few other places too.
Oh, okay.
But it does come, but also, too, like I said, they can match it to Chichen Itza. Now, it doesn't mean that it was made there. It could have just been some left over. They could have carried it from Georgia. They could have carried it to Chichen Itza. Chichen Itza could have carried it to Georgia. You know, it could pass, like you're talking about, trade. Now, we already know that the trade networks from back then traded a lot in amber because they know that amber moved across Europe. So we already know that the Europeans didn't move across a lot of parts of Europe at the time, but the amber did,
mm-hmm.
you know, from hand to hand. So you're thinking about bags of that clay. If the Maya already considered it extremely valuable in a trade, then it could have easily been traded with everybody as it marched along.
Yeah.
You know, or they could have just had groups of people that were trading. That's all they did was trade. That's how they made their money, you know, is go back and forth. Now, we know that Mesoamericans have visited American Southwest because of turquoise. They know they can trace the turquoise.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of Mississippi artifacts have also been found in the classic Mayan sites down there in the Yucatan. So
yes.
they can trace, which is funny to me that it's okay to say that it was traded with the Mississippi crew, but it's not okay to go up and say it was traded with the Georgia crew. That's always been kind of funny to me. Now, Robert Hall, for example, this fella has also found ritual and mythic diffusion from central Mexico, also ties in with the Mississippi cultures too. So it's a hot topic or a debated topic when you start getting into this. Because if you get on anything online and you start looking any of this stuff up, you can weigh it both ways. I can come on here right now and go, okay, all these guys are saying that there's no way that this pottery is Mayan. There's no way that these petroglyphs are Mayan. There's no way that this pigment, it's kind of like we talked about, this pigment, they trace it to one. But also what they don't tell you is that pigment they found in Chichen Itza also traces back to Florida, traces back to Arizona. You know, it has a bunch of other areas besides just one.
Yeah.
So it's like you're not telling a lie, but you're not telling the whole story. You're just telling it to bend it to your however you want the story to go. I could easily come in here and say that. I could easily come on and only tell the high points and go, that's how I want the story to go. I want it to be a Mayan tie because personally I do, because I personally believe that there was a lot more trade going on than what we're led to believe.
I believe that too. More. Yeah, absolutely.
Or I could also come on here and go, all of this is crap. The Mayan never went to Georgia. What I just told you was, you know, you can debate every bit of it. You can debate it that it was all the Native American culture that was the Cree Indian before the Maya ever did it. I mean, we can go on and on and on in circles. But if you look at this thing just as a simple, like I said, as just a simple Occam's razor type deal, the easiest way to explain it is trade.
Trade routes. We know they were worldwide, too.
Well, that's the easiest way to explain it. Whether you want to say they were sailing, whether you want to say they were had llamas or horses or whatever, and they were going back and forth all through there and taking months and months of trading. Any way you want to say it, it was trade routes. Well, okay, it's trade routes. But let me ask you this. Once you're trading in goods, it's not long before people are using that as a highway. You see what I'm saying? It's not long.
Absolutely.
Look at a train. A train is only made to move goods nowadays. You know, they used
mm-hmm.
to, but people still jump the train. They still take the so if you were going, why wouldn't I work for a trader? And I'm like, look, like we've always said, even when we talked about the Vikings, if you were sold into slavery with a Mayan and that was your and he was like, I'm going to work for this trade group. You're going to be I'm giving you my son, Kyle, and I want you to he's your slave now and all that stuff. And then my son goes and y'all get up to Georgia and then he's like, psh, I'm out of here.
Yeah.
Well, what are you going to do? You got to get back. You got to go. You're not going to spend months looking for him. You're just like, I guess he got away. I'll tell his dad that he got killed and it won't reflect bad on me and it won't reflect bad on him or none of that. We'll just keep going. So I look at these things as people with that knowledge alone could have passed it along. I mean, it's no different than people are now. So I kind of threw this out there where you could either go either way. People want to swing one way and say it was just regular Native Americans with no trade with the Maya, and that's the way it worked, or you want to say the Maya actually marched up here and built a group up here and all that. I don't know that it was so much that way as so much. It just seems to me like there was a large trade route amongst the natives of this area. And I know when you use the term native, it always makes you want to think back of barefoot loincloth. It wasn't like that. Yeah, it was in some. It's still like that way in some. But also, too, a lot of it was extremely advanced. They had, you know, they had kings and queens and princes. And they had everything the way we normally see a vassal ship and things now. So I think that it's easier to explain with a trade system of how all this stuff worked necessarily than giant groups of Maya living in Georgia.
Yeah,
I'm not
agree.
Saying that they weren't a small group, but I think that there was, a large group. I think that there was a small group of them living in Georgia And that may be kind of where all this came from. And like we said, we've already tied these petroglyphs into it. So I know it kind of tosses that idea around. So I hope you enjoyed it. That's just one of those things that I thought I might want to clear up and explain while I'm talking about it, because we've got a lot of hate mail in the past about talking about things. And then people are like, you're talking out of your ass. You need to do some more research. You need to do some more of this. So you looked into it now and kind of bring everybody up to speed. So when we talk about the Mayan ties with Georgia or talk about that there, maybe it's not a physical tie, like I said, with groups of people living there, but there was definitely a trade route involved in that.
I believe it. Now, speaking of petroglyphs, I'm going to get into the Anubis Caves.
We have mentioned a number of New World sites at which ancient Old World writing has been found. These examples, of which there are many, serve to show that before the Dark Ages, knowledge of the New World was fairly common and that man has always been curious and resourceful. One of the most unusual examples of ancient Old World inscriptions in the New World is found in northwestern Oklahoma. The inscriptions are located on the walls of the Anubis Cave. If you think that name is Egyptian, you are correct. Inside the cave are a number of ancient Egyptian hieroglyphs. These include a human figure standing on a three-dimensional cube. Rays extend from the figure's head. Anubis, the Egyptian god that was said to conduct the souls of the dead to judgment, also appears. However, the oddest element among the figures is the presence of Celtic Ogham inscriptions. They indicate that the cave was used for Celtic ceremonies. Were the Celts familiar with Egyptian hieroglyphics? Or was this North American cave visited in ancient times by both the Egyptians and the Celts?
The Anubis Cave site, located in the Oklahoma Panhandle, is one of the most significant examples of another culture being in North America before Christopher Columbus in 1492. Now, both the epigraphy and mythology that is carved into these walls of these caves are interwoven into an elaborate heliolithic apparatus that was precisely calibrated towards the equinoxes. So they're not just carvings that don't mean anything. It was elaborately planned. Whoever did this knew what they were doing, and they did it on purpose.
Of the sites that I've seen, and I've seen them in the Orient, in Ireland, in Europe, across America, this is one of the most exciting.
Now, there are phrases written in Celtic, etched in Ogham. And if you don't know what Ogham is, or Ogham, it's an alphabetical script used for inscriptions in an archaic form of Irish from about the 5th or 10th century. And there's also even Libyan carvings in there. Now, these scripts, which have been successfully translated, they refer to the Bel and the Grian, which are both Celtic names for the sun and god. Now, archaeologists believe that the Anubis Caves are the best surviving records of the cult of Mithras. Now, Mithras is an old world religion that spanned the Persian and Roman empires. Now, Gloria Farley, she was the first to be shown these caves back in 1978, and it was discovered by just a local rancher. It was on his property. I guess he was milling around one day and just noticed it. Like, that looks odd.
Now, before we jump in, Anubis, for those that don't know, maybe you need to clear that up. Anubis is actually the god of death, or the protector of the dead. He's actually an Egyptian. He's the jackal-headed god of the Egyptians. Whenever you see that mask and all that, or those guys that wear it, but he's actually considered the protector of the dead, or the god of funerals and death.
That's 100%
who Anubis
right.
is.
Yeah, now remember even on, what's the movie, Stargate, one of the characters is the Anubis.
I want one of those masks so bad, I can't hardly stand it.
Right, now based on the earlier translations that I mentioned earlier, the sun symbols and the general orientation of the caves, it's predicted that these caves contained an equinox alignment involving light and shadow interplay. So whoever set this up, they set it up so that on the equinoxes, shadows will move along these petroglyphs and these ogams, and it'll show that it has meaning. Someone knew about it, the position and everything.
That's cool, man.
Now, there are numerous documentaries about the Anubis caves that you can find on YouTube. I almost said NoobTube. Now, Scott Monahan of Denver, Colorado, produced the first documentary, and this was in 1984 and 1985, and it's called The History of the Rocks. And there's a newer one, and it's just called Old News. And I suggest if you're interested in these Anubis caves, you can go on there and you can see it. Also, I believe it was on America Unearthed. I think Scott Walter went and paid a visit to the Anubis caves. I didn't see that episode specifically, but it was pretty cool. Now, getting back to Mithra, or Mithra, or Mithras. You've heard of this before.
Yes.
It was a sun god, and his partner, Varuna, they were worshipped in India before 2000 BC. Now, as the worship of Mithra spread to Persia and Asia Minor, its name kind of changed, and it went from Mitra to Mithra. And then later, the Romans adopted him as the god Mithras, and the worship was spread, especially among the Roman soldiers of that time. Now, Roman Mithraism underwent even more changes as it spread to the Celtic peoples of Britain. So when the Romans moved into what is nowadays England, Scotland, Ireland, and stuff like that, again, this Mithraism was brought there to that region, and it was changed even more. Now, it was specifically during these later times that the great emphasis on was placed on Mithras slaying a bull, mm-hmm. known as Tauroctony. Now, a bull with ribs happens to be etched in a Celtic style, and it's found in Cave 3 there at the Anubis Caves. So this fits right in with maybe some Celtic people had carved these things. It fits right in line with their mythology. Now, Mithras, the character, is often shown wearing a cape with stars. Now, in Anubis Cave number 2, there's a figure there depicted with a cape on, and it's placed specifically between the rising and setting sun in the picture. The etching of the figure has 7 rays emanating from its head. Now, Mithrae is the ancient Irish word for rays of the sun, and the 7 rays may also, they think, might represent the 7 grades of the Mithraic initiation. Apparently, there's 7 steps when you're initiated into this Mithraism, and that's depicted in this etching too. Now, the Anubis Caves themselves are a series of 6 eroded caves in a low sandstone bluff that faces west. It's all sandstone, and there's, out of the 5 main caves, they're clustered together. The 6th is a little farther away. So 5 of them are real close compact. Another one is a little farther away. Now, in the farther away ones, there's Plains Indian zoomorphic petroglyphs there. Pictures of horses, pictures of the animals that are common to that area. And now they know that that's 100% Native American. But what they really like are these other ones in the other remaining caves, because it looks like it's Celtic, Roman, Egyptian, some think, because of the Anubis dog. It's really bizarre. Now, caves 1 and 3 are interconnected by eroded windows between them. Now, these carvings, they did some testing on them, and indirect carbon-14 dating was completed by a professor named Ron Dorn. Now, he's from Arizona State University. Now, using his specific technique for dating rock, varnish, or rock patina, he concluded that the inscriptions were at least 2,000 years old at that time, which was 1985 when he did these tests. Now, it says that his findings could be, you know, within a range of 300 years, but pretty close. It's around 2,000 years old. So they know that they're old, well older than Christopher Columbus being here.
Mm-hmm.
Now, let's specifically cave by cave. Now, in cave 1, the engravings are seen from the ground. But in cave 2 and 3, you can't really see it from the ground. You have to climb up in there to get to see it.
That was on Scott Walter's show. They had to actually climb up in it.
Okay. Now, in cave 2 and 3, there's no light and shadow play there. In cave 1, there are 7 figures that have been interpreted as representing 7 constellations. Now, back to caves 2 and 3, they're inscribed, so onlookers standing outside, when you get up on this platform, this raised area, can view the interplay of the light and shadow. Now, this is what they're talking about specifically when it comes to the equinoxes. As the shadow moves across the cave, it moves across this specific alignment.
Mm-hmm.
And they say it's almost like a silent opera, as you can see a series of images linked by the shadow play as it moves across. It kind of tells a story.
This is the early movie theater, and we're seeing art in motion. The power of art in motion and the power of art in time. This is transcending time. The various exact matchings throughout this, I can't call it anything else but the performance, and makes a beautiful mimic of the setting sun at equinox. This is a powerful solar construct and a powerful device that's showing our cultural history.
So when you're there to watch this shadow move across the walls of the cave, it's kind of telling a little story, and that's what's so cool about it. is it's specifically set up. And whoever did it, they had to know what they were doing. Now, Ogham writing, if you want to know what it looks like, it's a system using parallel lines in groups that represent letters within their language, okay? Mm-hmm. Now, you know when you're scoring a game of dominoes or you're counting things, you know how you'll make four like vertical lines, and then on the fifth one, you'll do a diagonal one to group it as a number five. Well, those vertical lines, not now minus the diagonal line, it's those vertical lines. That kind of looks like Ogham writing. And that's what the shadow moves. It moves along that Ogham writing, which in turn corresponds to letters, which they think, you know, is telling the story. So it's specifically set up. And it's really neat if you go on there and you look at some of the photographs, and I'll post several of these photographs in there on the website, expandedperspectives.com. You can see them. It really is pretty neat. And I would like to be there on the equinox to actually see this stuff.
We're not that far away.
I know, but apparently it's on private land. It's not like it's a national park or anything.
Let's go up and do some sweet talking.
Well, if you could figure out who actually owns the land, yeah, right.
Why don't you go to the coffee shop around there? You can find some old boy let you on there.
Right, I'm sure somebody
does. Or you
got to
be real quick. You got to run out there real fast and jump, look around.
I wonder if they have surveillance cameras or anything like that.
I don't creep. I'm too old to be creeping.
No. If you're interested in these Ogham writings and these Anubis caves, there's a great paper that you can read online by Philip Leonard. Now, Mr. Leonard, he's been studying these Anubis caves himself for over 25 years. And this paper, it's really like a small book. It's like 70-something pages long. It has photographs in it. It has diagrams in it. It has detailed drawings of all the glyphs that are there at the caves. And I'll put a link to that as well in the show notes. It's a free PDF version. I mean, it's a 70-page document with photos and everything, and you can read it for absolutely free.
Oh, that's awesome.
So it's pretty cool that he offers that up there. I mean, he could very easily sell this thing. But anyways, if you read in that paper, he goes on to say, he says, events observed in this cave are related to daylight hours. Everything takes place in sunlight. The equinox alignments at the Anubis caves were created to operate in a sequence containing repeated times. This suggests a connection with ritualistic events or to function as a portrayal of religious beliefs. The sequence of alignments begins in this cave. Cave 3, it appears to be intended more as a calendar regulator rather than the ones that are in Cave 2 and 1. Cave 3 does contain symbolic panels, but they are descriptive of important dates. This is in contrast to Cave 2, whose panel is best described as portraying a story. Now, near the floor of this cave is a scattering of stars, five in which are clearly defined, and another that are quite faint. On the north wall is a cluster of another group of stars. Now, their number is intermittent, but appears to be about six or eight. There is some overlap and additional lines, making it difficult to determine what is exactly intended by these marks. The group of marks is positioned above an inscription, which looks like a Libyan or Numidian script. Now, Cave 2 has possibly three inscriptions in script. The south end of the cave has a number of marks whose meaning and purpose have alluded me to this date, so he doesn't know what it is.
I got you.
They've deciphered some, and some of the other ones they haven't deciphered. Now, unfortunately, there's one problem. The cave is made up of sandstone.
Oh, yeah, I know where you're going with this, because I saw some of the videos I've seen on it.
Right. Now, sandstone, if you're not familiar with sandstone, we have a lot of it around here. It's very fragile.
It's just exactly what it sounds like. It's basically sand that's pressed into a stone. I mean, you can easily carve into it. And from what I saw, there was a lot of other stuff carved around it, and it was easily eroding away. Kids were going up there and carving their names in it.
Exactly.
And stuff. That's what I saw a lot of.
Now, it's suffered some damage over the years. There's even cowboy graffiti on there, teenager graffiti that's nearby it. And some of the graffiti, like you were talking about, has actually damaged some of the glyphs.
Yeah.
Now, most discouraging, again, these buffoons, much like the ones we were talking about with the King Tut thing.
Yeah.
Get ready for this. An early researcher callously affected the site by taking molds of many of the petroglyphs without using a release coating to protect the outer layer of the patina.
Great.
Of these glyphs. As a result, the latex molds that they made stuck to the patina and accidentally came off when they removed the molds, destroying many of the glyphs. So without this protective layer of natural patina, many of the Anubis cave petroglyphs have been worn away by natural erosion. Some, they say, easily seen 20 years ago can now hardly even be made out.
Oh, man.
So, you know, it's been there for 2,000 years, and because of these morons going around and making these molds, it's going away. I mean, within the last 20 years, I mean, another 10 years, they said that a lot of it, you may not even be able to see it anymore. And there's nothing, I guess, they can really do about it.
There's nothing they can. There's not a thing they can do now.
It says, for an example, on the left side of Cave 2, there's an image of a horse that, you know, can no longer be seen with the naked eye. The same thing is true of etchings on the right side of Cave 2, where much of the details are either eroded or have been vandalized. Now, Carl Lehrberger, who has studied archaeological and sacred sites all over North America for more than 25 years, with a specific focus on old world peoples in America before Columbus, he wrote an article about the Anubis Caves in Ancient American Magazine.
Now, yeah.
I read Ancient American Magazine all the time. I love it. Now, in fact, the publisher at Inner Traditions just sent me his latest book to review. It's called The Secrets of Ancient America. I could see it sitting over there on the desk.
Yeah.
It's called, like I said, Secrets of Ancient America, Archaeoastronomy and the Legacy of the Phoenicians, Celts, and Other Forgotten Explorers. And he wrote that book. Now, anyway, back to this episode or issue of Ancient American Magazine. It's issue number 68 if you're really interested. Now, Carl goes on to say, the equinox alignments at the Anubis Caves were not solely established for calendar keeping and calibrations. Instead, they were created as part of a complex movement involving the constellations interwoven into ancient mythology and cosmology. While ruins of several Mithraic temples or Mithraeusiums survive in Europe today, none are known to me that display the same astronomical details, cosmology, and mythology that are found at the Anubis Caves. Whoever inscribed them in Oklahoma had to know Ogham script, the Celtic language, astronomy, and Mithraic religious symbolism in use, and they had to do it over 1,500 years ago.
So, but nobody wants to believe it's
nobody wants to true. Believe that it's real. Some people think
so. They didn't save it. They didn't.
They think that somebody somewhere, maybe in the early 20s or so, came along and inscribed all this stuff. But that's what Carl was saying. He's like, whoever did it, they had to know ancient Ogham script. They had to know Celtic language. They had to know astronomy. They had to know Mithraic religious symbolism. And they had to know all that stuff as it was in use 1,500 years ago. Had to be an awfully smart person go in there and fake this. I mean, I think they're absolutely real. And if you look at the pictures, it's amazing. It's pretty cool that somebody... which makes me want to know, were the caves natural and they stumbled upon them? Or did they kind of carve out the caves? Because it's made of sandstone. You could carve a cave out of sandstone within a couple months. I mean, it would be easy to do. Now, this isn't the only archaeological site within the area. Nearby, there's the archaeological site known as the Sun Temple. Also, Crack Cave is nearby. And Crack Cave also has strange equinox alignments that uses shadow play to tell a story and things. And maybe on a future date, I'll get into that. But it's pretty cool. It's pretty cool. And I love these sites. I love these ancient places that you see here in North America that show, much like you were talking about the Mayans, there was somebody here, most likely Celtic or Roman.
Yeah.
That's another thing. They found Roman coins in this area.
Yep.
And it's just right there in Oklahoma.
Yeah. There's a lot more to it that, and we've got into a bunch of it, but there's a lot more to it. That's another thing. I've had people ask me before, friends and family, and ask me, well, you know, why didn't they have better writing? You look at the runes, you look at the Ogham. I don't think people understand the reason they're straight lines is because you're carving in stone.
Yeah.
It's hard to carve a bend.
Perfect cursive and stuff. Yeah.
So that's why that Ogham writing is lines. That's why the runes are lines. That's the reason there's lines and dots is because that's how you carve, because that's what they were carving in. That's what they were writing in. You know, was
much
stone.
Like, you know, Sanskrit, much like the Sumerians writing, much like the Hebrew writing on the Decalogue stone and stuff. It's pretty basic stuff.
Yeah.
You know. Anyways, I thought that was interesting. Well, stick around, folks. We're going to take a quick break. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives.
All right, folks, thanks so much for sticking around with us today. We hope you really enjoyed some of those ancient history. We did our best to bring in some interesting things. I got a few people I'd like to say thanks to. I'd like to say thanks to Mr. George Harrell and Mr. Ryan Stevens and Rich Hiber, and they've been posting and sending us a bunch of links on Facebook. So, folks, if you've got a Facebook, go ahead and follow us, please. Expanded Perspectives. Feel free to send us messages, send us links. You can post some stuff on the page. I mean, that's how we kind of stay in contact with everybody. We've also got the Twitter that we always work with. Also now Instagram. I've been Instagramming pictures of the books. We've got a cool interview coming up next Monday with Frank Joseph about some old school history stuff, and we've been kind of doing a little posting about that.
We got Red Pill Junkie coming on. And we've got, I think, Heidi Hollis is coming on. I'm going to talk about the Hat Man.
You're going to talk about it. That creeps me out. You can talk all about the Hat Man.
You're the one that did the story on the Hat Man before.
That's why it creeps me out.
I know, right? But yeah, we got a whole bunch of guests coming on. And yeah, thank you for the stories. In fact, Rich Hiber sent me a link just today about that the FBI, there's some new documents showing that Hitler did not die after World War II and that he fled to Argentina.
You're like,
and
no joke.
We knew about that. I'm like, we did an interview with Gerard Williams about over a year ago now.
I'm glad he's backing it up.
Specifically what he talked about. Now, the book that we did the interview on is an excellent book. It's called Grey Wolf. And I suggest you pick it up if you're interested in how, and it wasn't just Hitler. I mean, tens of thousands of Nazis fled to Argentina.
Yes.
Pretty shocking. And the most shocking thing is apparently our government knew about it.
Yeah. Yeah.
They just, you know, didn't want to tell everybody.
Well, I'm glad Rich sent that because it's one of those things that kind of reconfirms things that, you know, I mean, you know what I mean? It's kind of stop. If you got a scale, it's piling more stones on that side of the scale.
Yes, I agree.
You know, it kind of raises it up. So I really enjoyed that. Well, you're speaking of stuff sent to us. Ryan sent us one that I know you're going to love. And it's, remember when I discussed the robotic snake that looked like an eel?
Yeah.
Well, apparently they're using it, what they call, to sniff out pollution. They're going to start letting it loose in Lake Geneva.
Oh, great.
So, but hey, at least they're finally using some stuff there. And of course, leave it up to the Swiss to find a way to use it the sweet way, you know, where it'll probably crawl up out of the water and give you a hug. That's pretty awesome. But I like the fact that they're going to start using this for things along that deal. Now, they say it's going to, you know, like I said, it's going to have sensors to detect heavy metals like lead and then biosensors to look around for like living organisms like bacteria. And of course, I'm sure like the anabenas for taste and odor control and water and things like that. So it's really, that's a really interesting thing. So Rich, thanks for sending that. And then a little message here from our good buddy down there in San Antonio, Joseph. He's one of our UFC buddies. Loves to watch the show. So I'm glad you like the fights, man. We really love the fights. And I mean, you can't ever count out the Rumble, baby.
That's
Anthony
right.
Anthony Rumble Johnson.
That's right. Well, if you're new to the show and you found us on YouTube or wherever you're listening, maybe Dark Matter Radio, and this is your first time, don't forget to go to the website, expandedperspectives.com. We have all our past episodes on there. You can sign up for an elite service. Don't forget about that. We do another show every Thursday. And it's called Expanded Perspectives Elite. Signing up's easy. It's only $5 a month. And we got a back catalog now of about 25 shows on there.
Yeah.
So you can listen to all those. Don't forget about our phone number. We got it working again. That was my fault. 817-945-3828. Call in. Let others know what it is about Expanded Perspectives that you like. And you might find your voice being played during one of our breaks on one of our shows. Or just call us up and tell me and Cam that you think we're doing a good job, or you just have something you want to share with us. If you have a story, don't forget you can email the show, expandedperspectives@yahoo.com, or you can call and just leave the voicemail of your story. Either way, we like the stories that everybody shares. Everybody have a good week this week. Don't work too hard. And for those elite members, we'll speak to you on Thursday. For everybody else, we'll talk to you next Monday.
Peace.